Hello. Just to let you know that this episode contains strong language, and the following live recording has been edited down from its original length. Hello, and welcome to this bonus episode of The Reason Why, with me, Seamus Carey. This time, I'm joined by a live audience. Here at the Cornish Bank in my hometown of Falmouth. This event is part of the brand spanking new Falmouth International Arts Festival. Yay! 6 months have passed since the first podcast episode was released, and what a ride it's been so far. From something that started out as quite a lonely personal pursuit, driving about with no budget, collecting interviews, editing away in my shed, to becoming a much talked about series, sparking controversy and debate online, in households and workplaces. One man got in touch with me to say he'd had an existential identity crisis, all thanks to me. Some people liked it, but some people didn't. And it's good to remember that. They disagreed with my opinions, and one man accused me of being anti-Cornish. It's had over 39,000 downloads and made national newspaper headlines after a certain individual's remarks about the Cornish didn't go down so well. Sadly, the topics and issues raised throughout the series have carried on. If anything, some of them have even got worse. So I've invited back three original interviewees and two new friends we're yet to meet to form a panel and pick up where we left off. Joining me tonight, we have Michael Bunny, Cornwall councillor for the St Mewin and Ground Pound Division, as well as party development officer for Mebby and Curnow, the party for Cornwall. Michael featured in episode 6 and would proudly describe himself as a Cornish nationalist. Amanda Spencer, commercial director of Aspects Holidays, founded originally in 1989 as a family business. The company now boasts an impressive portfolio of 838 holiday rentals across Cornwall. Amanda was raised and went to school in St Ives and is now proud to employ 51 people, all who live locally. Marcus Elaine is a professional music conductor as well as being co-founder of Director of Communications for the charity Black Voices Cornwall. Their vision is to enable Cornwall to become actively anti-racist. Emma Frankland, who featured in episode 8, Queer Cornwall, is a live performance and theatre artist who creates provocative work, often based around the themes of identity and gender politics. She grew up in Falmouth, however, now lives in Shoreham-by-Sea, just outside what she describes as the queer capital of the UK, Brighton. And finally, Matthew Zier, British DJ and current artistic director of Actors Touring Company, based in London. Matthew and I spoke in episode 7 about coming to Cornwall as a visitor and his own personal experiences of being a person of colour in a rural place. We'll discuss this topic as well as the housing crisis, gentrification, nationalism and the future of Cornwall here tonight with the help of our very special live audience. Have things got worse since the podcast came out? Did you agree or disagree with the opinions raised throughout the series? And what kind of hope is there for the future of Cornwall? Let's find out.
In The Reason Why.
So I want to dive straight in and get the ball rolling with some very controversial remarks which sparked wide debate across the UK. You may remember in episode 3 I spoke to Sir Tim Smit, the Dutch-born British businessman known for the Lost Gardens of Heligan and the Eden Project fame. We chatted about his good friend and TV chef Rick Stein and how some Cornish people too often look backwards with nostalgia-tinted glasses. Now, before we hear those famous remarks and get your opinion, I want to give you a bit of context to that interview. So Tim and I spoke in February 2021 whilst he was awaiting a planning verdict from Lostwithiel Town Council about a large new development project called Gillyflower Farm. We discussed during the interview the opposition he sometimes felt towards him as he tried to make big things happen in Cornwall.
Well, I'm aware that within Cornwall, there are a group of people who see me as a pretentious interloper there are narratives about me which are not true, but about how I was opportunistic coming to Cornwall, able to make benefit from Cornwall's perceived economic challenges, and that I was able to put all sorts of things together which enabled me to benefit in some way, which is, if people choose to look at it that way, that's fine. But there's not a grain of truth in it.
Clearly, at this point, he was aware of his contentious position within the Cornish community, which I think is really interesting, because we then got on talking about Rick Stein, his friend, and whether he could be blamed for negative gentrification within Cornwall. Tim decided to defend his friend Rick Stein's comments and his TV show, and he said this.
One of the problems in Cornwall is if you say anything, if you're not Cornish, if you say anything about it, they say, you arrogant so-and-so speaking for the Cornish. And you feel, I don't, but you feel like saying, well, if you were a bit more fucking articulate, you could speak up yourself, but you haven't. You've all got mums who made the best pasties in the world, and it's fantastic, and it's fabulous. And you talk about the good old days, and the good old days never were the good old days. They've been bad for about 70 years, and they've been bad because tossers like you. And that's what I would actually say to quite a lot of Cornish people. I really would, because you cannot define your life in terms of what you don't like. You've got to actually define your life sometimes in terms of the sunny uplands you'd like to aspire to. And what makes me cross is that there was plenty to be genuinely angry about, injustice in Cornwall in terms of the way central government saw it. And it was allowed to be painted as if it was political as opposed to factually correct. And it's factually correct that Cornwall has been dealt a bad hand and it deserves significantly more.
Just so you know, in case you didn't know, that this interview got picked up by the Guardian newspaper and then Cornwall Live, which had an unfortunately evil-looking picture of Tim with it. And it then snowballed throughout the rest of the day. And because of the nature of the podcast, I've had to stay and remain balanced and neutral about this. So I want to open up this discussion of what Tim Smith said to our panel. Firstly, Michael Bunny.
Yeah, so I thought you probably would come to me first, Seamus, on this one. So I should say, Tim moved to the village where I'm from, which is Goran. So I've known Tim and his family for a very, very long time. And particularly on the back of that, I find those comments really disappointing. And that's me being gentle. I think they're very, very offensive. And I think they do Tim a massive disfavour as well. And I think they do all of the projects, things like the Lost Gardens of Heligan that I love, and the Eden Project as well. I think they do them a massive disfavour, because to make comments like, if you were more fucking articulate, we wouldn't need to speak up for you. If that was said about any group, rightly so, there would be outrage at those types of comments. You know, I like to think I'm vaguely articulate. I have grown up in families that are massively articulate. I know many, many Cornish women and men and people from all over the world. Every group of society and community has incredibly articulate people. And on all these issues tonight, we need to hear the voices from the ground. We need to have a bottom-up approach to decision-making. And that means, you know, talking about people not being articulate, maybe people aren't listening to the voices that are trying to speak and be heard. So I'm very disappointed. For me, I don't want to spend this evening talking about Tim Smith. I think it was ill-judged. I think the wider issues of top-down politics and of disrespect for divergent voices are the things that we should be talking about. So, you know, Tim, you did a bad job there, and you should hold your hands up and you should apologise for that.
I just want to, do you think there's anything in the fact, his comment about looking forward and not looking backwards?
Yeah, I do.
Aspirations.
So, I do. Thank you, Seamus. Yeah, so in my notes, I massively agree with that. I don't define my, we all have multiple identities, don't we? But I don't define myself by what I dislike. Optimism, positivity, community, that's the way forward. So I hugely agree with Tim. Many things he's done in terms of positive energy and, you know, hopeful change, that's what we should be focusing on. But I still think even that comment, it's a massive disfavour, because so many Cornish people and so many communities all over the world are looking forward. We just need to respect and hear their voices.
Is there anyone on Tim Smith's comments? Anybody want to come in? Emma Franklin.
I mean, what it makes me think of, and I think this is something that is central to all the things we're going to talk about, but it makes me think of the language around colonization. And, you know, to situate for people listening at home, I'm a white person. So, you know, with that context of talking about colonization in any way, recognizing my my complicity in that as a white person from this country. But there's something that when people talk about moving towards decolonization, that decolonization is not a place we can ever get to because it happened. We are where we are. And so we can make moves towards, we can't ever undo it. And so I think what I agree with in everything that Michael said and in what Tim said is about, you know, the history of Cornwall being dealt a bad hand, for sure. Like, you know, there's been such deprivation, like economic, economic imbalances that have led to a lot of the issues that are going to come up for us today. And the attitude of, well, I'm trying to do something about it, and these people, and someone speaking on behalf of a people and an idea of what those people are, is inherently where I think those comments go off the path and go wrong. Because, you know, you're right, like, it can't be someone coming in and fixing a problem. It's got to come from the people, whoever they are.
While we're on it, because Tim Smith did go on Radio Cornwall on the 17th of February 2022, and he made a sort of defence statement, and when I approached Tim to come on this, they didn't let him, and Tim's daughter was going to come on and speak on his behalf, but she was busy, unfortunately, so they sent me his statement, and some of it I love. Tim Smith said, "If I didn't have the goodwill of Cornish people, I would be distressed beyond measure. This isn't about the Cornish people. It is about a particular mindset is what I was attacking. That's why I've been upset by the way the interview has been edited, because it is very specifically about defending my friend Rick Stein from the accusation that he is personally responsible somehow for taking Cornwall to a place where it shouldn't be. This is my favourite bit. I just thought it was incredibly unfair. Look, I regret that I caused upset, but to be honest, I was doing an interview on a friend's podcast, not expecting it to be of wide circulation, and was making a personal point, as one might around a fireside, about the fact that Cornwall, in fact the opposite, that Cornwall is in a superb place. I don't know anywhere in the world that I'd rather be than Cornwall."
Sorry, so that's not an apology. That's the trouble. I accept we all get it wrong sometimes, but you hold your hand up, you apologise, you unpick some of the underlying assumptions that were expressed and revealed through what you've said, and you own it and you apologise for it. I'm, again, really disappointed on a personal level. That's not a proper apology. It's a fake, a bit like the Priti Patel apology, you know, just useless, really.
Yeah. We've got someone here that put their hand up. Hello.
Hello. I'm not defending Tim. I've met him a number of times. I feel that actually what Tim does is he throws stones and he sees what happens. So I think what you've read is a cover-up by people he works with. And I've met some of those, and he works with some fantastic people. But I think he deliberately throws stones to see what happens. And I think that's what Tim does. And sometimes they piss people off.
Which is ironic, because he lives in a big glass house.
It's annoying when someone gets there first, isn't it? No, I didn't think of that one. Because the thing is, there is a counter-argument, which is Tim Smith makes huge things happen, and he does provide lots of employment, and he does, you know, he has contributed massively to the culture of Cornwall, and that's a funny thing where I sit on the fence, because I can see both sides of it. Anybody else in the audience? We're going to open up quickly to the audience.
Hey, I understand the argument you're making of, like, he's made these really big projects happen, but don't you think that also plays into the narrative that we see across the whole UK of trickle-down economics, this idea that you need someone to come and make a really big project? I understand that has provided, like, real jobs and real economic success, but it's also taken away the opportunity for things to happen from the ground up. And it's very easy for people who've already come in with a lot of money to say, well, look what I did. But that's also taken away redistributed resources to see what the community might have made. And so you don't actually get the chance to see what the alternatives could be from, like, radical community action.
Thank you. So I just want to give you the end of the story here. The end of the story is, in April 2022, the plan for Tim Smith's horticultural centre was rejected by councillors. The proposals of Gillyflower Farm near Lostwithiel had more than 300 objections. Lostwithiel Town Council said the proposal would decimate the local economy. So there was a narrative, a rumour that got back to me that it might have been my fault that he didn't get that. That didn't go through. Am I to blame? Do you want to put that question out there? Does anyone? Should I worry about that? Because no.
Be congratulated, Seamus.
Okay. All right. Let's remind ourselves where we are for a second. We're recording live from this wonderful recently opened music and arts venue, the Cornish Bank, run by two good friends of mine. Now, from its name, you can probably guess that it was originally a bank. It's been several things since then, most recently a one-stop shop for Cornwall Council, but when that closed, it remained unoccupied. Until Will Greenham and Rufus Morris came along and decided to take the mighty risk and transform this space into a fully functioning bar, cafe, kitchen, rehearsal space, comedy, music and theatre venue, which attracts local and international artists. In my opinion, this is what Falmouth has always needed, especially when I was growing up. It's created a space for a scene to form within, and it's provided employment for local people, including myself. However, if you look around, you'll spot large filament light bulbs, beers from independent breweries, 90s haircuts behind the bar, and God forbid, a very trendy colour palette. Are these the telltale signs of gentrification? Has this venue taken something away from the people who used to live here or worked in the bank or whatever? Has it made the town better? Has it taken something away? And as Danny North, who used to run Pizza Please, he quoted his friend to me in an interview and he said this.
What's wrong with a bit of gentrification? Are you saying poor people can't have nice coffee too?
What's wrong with a bit of gentrification? Matthew Zier, you had a good story in our original interview from London about the Box Park.
Yeah, so Box Park is a new venture, a fairly new venture in Brixton, which has been a widely held kind of centre of the Caribbean community for, 50 years now. Box Park, as a concept, is run by some very well-off, middle-class white folk from not London. I spotted an exchange when I went there once between an elderly black woman, who I'd assumed was from the local community, and this guy who was stood at the front and seemed to be the manager, and she simply said, but it's not for us. You never invited us in. Which I found kind of like slightly unnerving, actually, because I agree, I don't think gentrification is inherently negative. I don't think it's an inherently bad idea to bring jobs, amenities, resources, art, infrastructure to places that don't have it. You know, I think if you look right now at the government's dreadful idea about levelling up by relocating arts organisations out of London into other places, as opposed to investing in those places in the first place, I just think it's an exciting idea, but it's got to be done sensitively, and it's got to be done with the people who already live there, so you're not pushing people out.
And there was a topic that you, a story you told me about last night, or since you've been down from London, because I guess there's a narrative that people come to a place and they change it, and whether it's for the worse or for the better. And somebody made a comment to you last night.
Yes.
About this space, was it?
Right here. Well, she was talking about arts in general, and she was saying that the art scene, you know, before the university was here, when her grandparents, I think, had been around, was networked and connected, and now it was a bunch of outsiders who didn't really know what they were doing here and had no right to provide. And there was this sense, I felt attacked, because she turned to me and she just said, it was much better before, and turned around. So it feels exclusionary, ultimately.
Gentrification, negative or positive?
Okay, so I just want to unpick the word gentrification, because there are issues with that word, obviously. But if we're talking instead about community action, and if we're talking about local people, whether they're business holders or whether they're community enterprise groups, or taking a building and developing it and evolving it, I think that's absolutely brilliant. This looks fantastic. Redruth is a really exciting town at the moment with huge levels of community action. St Austell, which I think gets a really bad deal, which is near where I'm from. We've got the Market House, which again has been taken back to its original glory with art spaces. And I think, you know, we just need to make sure, I think it was perfectly expressed, that the community are involved and the community are at the absolute heart. And I mean by that, families and people that have been here for hundreds and hundreds of years, and people that come here regularly or people that have just arrived. We're all part of this brilliantly diverse Cornish community, and let's evolve and improve our area. And if by gentrification we mean that, fantastic. If we mean poshing places up so ordinary people can't afford to go there, then I'm not part of that.
Yeah, and I think it's got to be giving to, not taking from.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Mandy Spencer.
I mean, just from my sort of side of things in tourism, I think the reason the tourist industry in Cornwall, and certainly in certain areas of Cornwall, has expanded is the fact that there is more to do, more to come down for out of season. So we're not just looking at the bucket and spade holidays of long ago. Without these kind of venues, a lot of people wouldn't have the same reason to visit. So, you know, I think if we use this building as one example, there is the negative connotation that, you know, we don't have enough banks. So, you know, you'll have the argument from a lot of local people, and I agree to a lesser or greater extent that it's a pain to try and go to a bank because they've closed down. I live in Hale and there aren't any anymore. When I moved there, there were three.
I think this bank closed a long time ago, didn't it?
It did.
Just the fact
I think it's just the fact that it is a bank. So I'm just saying there are some things that people may focus on as a loss to the community as opposed to a benefit.
Marcus Elaine.
I think that's just on that. I'd probably challenge that in terms of how are we going to know? I think the problem that we're missing is that very rarely do we ever go, we never take that person first approach. We're all sitting here, and we've been guilty of it too, of saying we think we know what is best for the communities, but actually in actual fact we don't. And I think there is no way we could ever represent or equally kind of advocate for every member of our perceived community. And I think there's a lot to be said around what is community, because I think it means very different things to each and every one of us. So to say that, you know, the community might be missing out on something, or, you know, there's something there that isn't that the community would want, based on whose rationale? I think that's the question. And what we need to do, I think, moving forward, is we need to be just speaking to everyday Joe blogs that have been here for centuries, that have been here for 2 days, because their needs are going to be very different.
I think what I'm fascinated about is making somewhere more desirable for the community, and then it's being desired outside Cornwall. And if you listen to episode 2 about Pornwall and episode 3 about overexposure, there's a thing about it being in the press and being in the media. And even since I released the podcast, there was an article in Condé Nast Traveller, and it listed my favourite beach, which I, in my childhood, was this secret little beach, which I feel very precious about. And there it is, being told. And I, on my cynical days, I feel really angry. And then on my happy days, I want to share that beach. And that's what I find, because I, just to be clear, I love this bank and this venue, and I'm glad it's here. But it's an interesting thing about making somewhere more desirable, which attracts people, which maybe adds to the problem. And then where do you put the blame? And a good example is a friend, Danny North, again, did an event on Castle Beach recently, selling pizza. Yeah, on Castle Beach. And a friend of mine, who I won't name, he said, fucking hell. All the hipsters were down there. All down there. We had one last spot in Falmouth where we could go and it'd just be us, you know, all the locals. And now they're all down there with their hats and And I thought, the way he described a hipster was exactly how I dress. So there is a thing about what is a hipster. You know, it's so easy with labelling and blaming of people coming in. That whole mentality, which is gentrification, it gets mixed up, doesn't it?
Yeah, and it's tribalism, isn't it? It says you sit outside the group, so you're not welcome here, which is what we'll talk about later.
I think about it all the time. I'm making theatre shows. Who goes to see theatre shows? You know? I mean, I'm not going to ask the painful question of... Yeah. That wasn't the painful question. The painful question was, who here would identify as being middle class?
It's not middle class.
Is it not?
No. So when you're talking about gentrification, who are you saying are the gentry? And the process of gentrification tends to be that the cool people with some talent and resources in a community do cool things, like they make this bank and they put on really great arts festivals and people come along and it's affordable, it's accessible, they run Kayleys, they run music things, whatever. It's fun. I grew up in Cornwall, I went to Knee High Theatre, I went to all these really affordable local theatres. I had more cultural access, I would argue, than a kid growing up in London. And I went to London at 18 and I thought, this is going to be amazing, there's going to be all the arts. But they were really expensive, they were really inaccessible, they were not... I felt there was more homegrown, homemade culture here. Gentrification is when people see that cool stuff happening and they move in. So who are the gentry? They're not the people making the arts and the culture and what makes this community great. They're people feeding off it and squeezing it out. And if you allow that to happen fully, the place becomes dead. So Falmouth isn't that, yeah, right? Because it's got lots of cool stuff going on. If that process continues, and the artists and the creatives and the people who haven't got loads of money to rub together but are doing all the cool stuff get squeezed out, you've got dead, sterile places. And that's where people, the lady from Aspects Holidays, that's where you need towns not to become predominantly holidaymakers, because then the attraction is gone. Because you don't come to visit a place that's dead and sterile. You come because it's cool and creative and it's got all this stuff going on. So we all want that same objective. How do you get that balance right? But this term gentrification, like actually the gentry, it's people. Who are the gentry? Who are you saying are the gentry?
Thank you. Thanks. It's time to talk about the very emotive and hot topic of housing, or rather the lack of housing in Cornwall. Out of interest, who here knows somebody or has they themselves been affected by the housing crisis? Okay, cool, that's most of the people in the room. I was completely overwhelmed by the response at the first episode of The Reason Why I Had, particularly from young people living in Cornwall struggling to find somewhere to live, sharing their dire situation, hoping I could help in some way. It's an ever-growing problem, and since the episode came out, it seems as if things have got worse. But I want to know what you think can be done about it. Is it wrong to put the blame on the individuals, like second homeowners, whatever, the companies and the tourism sector, when ultimately it feels to me like it's the governmental laws, legislation and policies that need to change? Or perhaps the government. Mandy, you grew up in St Ives.
I did.
But you don't live there anymore.
No.
Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, because I can't afford it.
How does that make you feel, not being able to live in the town that you... Would you like to live in the
town
that you grew up?
No, I actually wouldn't want to live in St Ives. There are some beautiful properties. There's some great places to go. There's some wonderful beaches. But actually, no, I like living where I live.
So let's be honest, you do somewhat hold a contentious position here, especially in this room. And
definitely.
You were quite anxious about coming here.
I was very anxious.
I'm very grateful for Mandy to come, because lots of people didn't want to talk about it. Lots of people don't want to come and put themselves in this position. How do you deal with the fact that you've grown up in Cornwall, you've seen it change with those problems of housing, you're affected by it yourself. Do you see yourself within that problem?
I don't think it would be right to say we're definitely not part of the problem. You know, we don't know that we're definitely part of the problem for sure. I think there needs to be registration. I think there needs to be some statistics that tells us exactly how many holiday homes there are, how many properties aren't rented out. So I wanted to make the big difference between second homes and a bona fide business that, as I say, is local with local employees, that's actually, irrespective of maybe some opinion, putting back into the community. So yeah, I mean, it is tough, and I think nobody's disputing that there's a housing issue. I'm not here to say, no, it's all fine and there's not a problem. I've got a member of my team that was struggling, was evicted from her property, and we had to pay a year's rent up front to a letting agent to secure her a home. Now, that put her ahead of probably someone just as deserving, but as an employee, that's what we wanted to do, make sure she had somewhere to live. So I know it's a problem. How much we contribute to it remains to be seen, really.
Okay, so let's put the question out there. Is it okay to have a business like Mandy's where it's employing local people? It's, like she said, the money's going back into this place. Is it okay to do that compared to the other companies that you've mentioned, the big players? How do we feel about this?
Marcus? I think there's a couple of things here for me. Is with any issue, if you recognise there's a problem and you're sitting on the fence as to whether you're part of the problem, I guess the question is what is your organisation, what is your company doing about the problem? Like, what's the solution? What's the recommendations?
Well, I think, you know, again, is it our job to solve the issue? I think, you know, it comes from higher up. I think there's definitely a housing problem. There's lots of, I've seen numerous new build estates go up around where I live, with a tiny splattering of affordable. They're not affordable. So the problem sits with government and the amount of housing that's being built that is then essentially not bought by local people. Whether they're holiday homes or not is irrelevant. It's the fact that we've come off the back of a very, very odd 2 years with lots of people wanting to move to Cornwall and paying ridiculous prices and driving the property prices up. That's not down to holiday letting
as such in its own right, but it has had a massive effect on pricing, and these properties aren't being built for local people.
Okay, so there's a lot to talk about here. The thing I was interested in is, I saw it myself. I walked past the office on the Falmouth High Street, and there was vandalism on the windows of Aspect Holidays. And just briefly describe what other stuff's been going on.
We've had a bit of vandalism on the Falmouth office, particularly, weirdly enough, and yet we represent less than 20 properties in the whole of Falmouth and surrounding areas. So I know that people feel we're part of the issue, but ironically, the posters that were plastered all over our windows were sort of referring to Airbnb, which we are not. We're not on Airbnb. We don't use Airbnb. I have to give credit to whoever designed the poster, mine, because they doctored it a little bit and made it a bit phallic. It was quite funny. If it hadn't have been on my windows, I would have laughed harder. But so we've had vandalism on the windows. We've had writing on our boards sort of saying community killers. You make people homeless. And also on social media, we've got our property managers that go to look at properties to take them on, drive cars that are logoed, and they've actually been tagged and sort of said vultures are circling around our area, that sort of thing. So it's not very nice for the team.
Thanks, Mandy. I want to bring in a counter argument here, which is we've got three members of Acorn UK, the National Tenants and Community Union, Oscar, Liam and Anna. Over to you.
We have organised to fight against evictions, and currently it's my own eviction that we're fighting against. I think this is the sixth time that we've been evicted, but this time, this feels very much like the last time. What we've done is we have actually spoken to the landlord, and we have actually spoken to the letting agent, and taking direct action as a way of actually trying to redress the power imbalance, because I believe and we believe that actually we all have a voice that needs to be heard, and we are fighting for housing justice. It's not a case of a deserving person who needs to have a home. There isn't one of us that can survive without one. And it's every one of us who has a home or has another home or another home that has a responsibility, because you're removing it from the market. You are removing it from people to be able to live permanently. There are people who can't afford to live in this place anymore, and the prices are going up because of the agents, and there's no other reason for it. The agents are pushing up the prices. That means Aspect Holidays, that means all of your other agents, and the agents who let to students as well.
Can we get to the nub of the question, which is the nub of the question is, what needs to change, what needs to happen to make this change? Do you guys come in on it?
And yeah, essentially, we've been doing our Homes Before Holidays campaign. We've been doing that for a few months, and it's been on exactly what people have been talking about here, where we want a added level of planning permission to convert or build any holiday home and any holiday property. And I was wondering if Amanda would like to sign our petition for that, and if she would support, and if Aspect Holidays would publicly support any motion for an added level of planning permission for second homes and holiday lets.
I'd absolutely support that. I think just what I'd like to mention is, as much as I understand how frustrating it is, I genuinely do. I've been in that situation. 20 years ago, I was a single mum. I had nowhere to live. So I do understand where people are coming from. I'm not somebody that's never had hardship. But I think my major issue is with the targeting of, specifically in this instance, the Falmouth office. I get where you're coming from, but I have two people that work full-time that are earning a living, that are enjoying their job, trying to contribute, live locally, and they're afraid to come to work. And that's because the office has been targeted. It's upsetting the wrong people. That's my point.
One more thing from Michael Bunny.
Yeah, so So I just want to say quickly, there has to be a political solution to this massive issue. There is a housing crisis. I get contacted every week by families that are homeless. And we need to put a ban or a limit on second homes. We need national legislation, because it isn't just Cornwall, to have planning requirements for holiday lets and second homes for a change of use. And we do need to build in the right places for genuinely affordable housing for local people as well. And, you know, we each have an individual responsibility, but we also shouldn't sow division. We're all part of the solution as well. And let's really tackle these issues at a political route, because that's the wider answer for the whole country and for our Cornish communities too.
Is it possible to jump in on that as well? Because I think you're right, right? And it's, you know, what do we actually do? And I really hate the fact that we try to reduce this down to some kind of binary of like, is this good? Is this bad? Is it, you know, is it up? Is it down? It's of course it isn't. This is a bigger problem. The bigger problem is capitalism. The bigger problem is always going to be where we're driven by profit, then there's always going to be that argument of, well, what can I do? I'm just making my living. I'm just doing this, because we're all operating underneath this system that doesn't help us. And I guess that maybe, you know, the what can we do in a country that doesn't go to revolution, what can we do with our rights to protest being taken away in the last few weeks? What can we do? And I think organizations like ACORN, organizations that are mobilizing, coming together, doing grassroots, communicating is a really good way to go. And you should look at what's in your area and, you know, actually, rather than saying we should talk to the community, get involved and be part of that conversation.
Okay, I want to leave that there just because I'd like to go on to the topic of second homes. Okay, let's the one we love. Let's just hear it from our friend Roger.
We all benefit from our visits to Cornwall, and Cornwall heavily benefits from the investment that people like. I mean, we've invested a lot of money in Cornwall already, and we spend a lot of money in Cornwall every year, and you've had some of it, and other, you know, and that's deliberate. It's quite deliberate, and I think it works for everybody. It's hard for me at the moment to see any sort of real downside for. The local, those who are permanently resident in the area. I mean, of course, there are probably tensions over medical services and education maybe and so on. But, I mean, it seems to work.
Listening to Roger makes me want to puke, if I'm honest. And it's not, you know, in the current housing crisis, it's not okay to have a second home. And, you know... And I made the point about the political solution, and there is a political solution, but politics is personal as well, and we all have a personal responsibility. And, you know, lovely Roger needs to reflect. He can take me for tea in Helford if he wants to. But I would gently say to him, like, there's loads of lovely annexes that have been converted by local Cornish families, my sister included, who's a single mum, who would not be able to stay in our village if it wasn't for her annex. So maybe Roger should give or rent, because it sounds like he can afford it, his second home to a lovely local family and come and rent my sister's annex. Because actually, there are solutions to this, and all of us are part of the problem. And if people think they can just keep treating Cornwall as a commodity and as a theme park and exploiting it, our community and our housing crisis and our environmental crisis as well is only going to worsen. So, Roger, wake up and smell the coffee.
I'd like to say a personal thank you to Roger, because in a way he set me off on a journey, and he was the first interview I did, and that made me go, hang on a minute, here's a good clip.
I think Cornwall should pat itself on the back. I think Cornwall's very, very well placed, if you know, to provide all sorts of things for people. I have a personal view that the victim status of some of our more remote territories, you know, Scotland, Wales, Cornwall, is ridiculous, really. I mean, come on, what's the point in wallowing in cash being funneled from the rest of the country? That seems a bit pointless. I mean, the Scots and the Welsh, I mean, people like that, do they, okay, everybody wants to run themselves, but they, you know, if the money's coming from somewhere else, well, you know, maybe you just have to sort of live with that. I think Cornwall should sort of be what it is. I think, you know, you shouldn't complain. I mean, you know, if they want to have a Cornish language festival, fine, hold one and I'm sure they'll get lots of visitors and they'll sell lots of beer.
The thing I find fascinating about Roger's comments is his unawareness. He's put a lot of money into this area, but he seems to get so little out of it. He's oblivious to the culture, to the people, and what actually goes on here when he's not on holiday. In a way, this interview acted as a catalyst for me to try throughout the rest of the series to subtly prove him wrong. Whether I achieved this, that's for you to decide, but hopefully the listener will have learnt that Cornwall does have a rich history and culture, and maybe the people aren't just holding language festivals to make lots of money from selling beer. And yet, it's not without its problems. Was Cornwall a nation? And is it one now? Personally, I think that's up for debate. Is it okay to call yourself a Cornish nationalist? What are the rules about belonging and identifying as Cornish? Let's find out after the break.